beloved brethren and sisters. There was a notable precedent set by Ezra in the revival of God's people, as we saw. In chapter 1, there was the principle of free giving, first of all of self, and then of possessions. Ezra set out the requirement of unity in chapter 3 of his book. And then he established the need for regularity of worship and thanksgiving in chapter 3. Ezra then proceeded to indicate that there was a principle of purity that was required of God's people if a revival were to take place. And then there was the preparation of one's heart, for Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to do it. There was dependence upon God, a realization that it was God's work. And then there was the principle of holiness, because purity was not merely a separation from the contamination around, there was the separation to God Almighty. And so on the basis of the principle of holiness set out in separation from the world and dedication to God Almighty, we commenced our analysis of Nehemiah. And we saw there that there were amazing parallels between difficulties Nehemiah faced and difficulties that the Apostle Paul faced. We might summarize these this way. With Nehemiah working on the walls of Jerusalem, he had to face, as we know, an enemy without. The enemy without consisted of Sanballat, Geshem, and Tobiah, and those alien powers that were confederate with them on the basis of hate of the Jews and their work. But also we found that there was quite a strong nucleus within the wall that also constituted an enemy. In fact, we saw at the very pith of the book of Nehemiah, centered around collusion existing between people inside the wall who had, in fact, marriage alliances with the enemy outside. And that as Nehemiah attempted to fortify the walls, his work was being eroded by individuals who moved as fifth columnists between Nehemiah and his work and Tobiah, the enemy outside the wall. So he really is facing two enemies, those outside the wall, those inside the wall. With the Apostle Paul, if we take his Corinthian situation, Paul had to face hostility outside from his fellow countrymen, particularly in the area of Galatia or in Macedonia at Philippi and Thessalonica. But the Apostle Paul also faced a strong nucleus of opposition to his authority in the Corinthian ecclesia. So he had what he termed elsewhere false brethren that worked alongside him in the work. Those, he said, who crept in secretly to spy out the liberty that they had in Christ Jesus. And Jude expressed it this way, "For admission has been secretly gained by some who long ago were designated for this condemnation." So you see, the pattern appears to be recurrent. But in God's work, you not only have the enemy outside the wall that you have to face, you have half-hearted allies within the framework of the truth who cannot seem to muster sufficient spirituality to see the dangers outside the wall, and consequently you have collusion with the enemy and a subsequent erosion of God's work because of that collusion. At this time, we do well to remember the difficulties that Nehemiah has faced to this point. In Nehemiah chapter 3, or rather chapter 2, we have the great welcome Nehemiah receives when he arrives at Jerusalem. And the first problem he faces is derision. And we'll make a list of these as we move through Nehemiah's account. In verse 19 of chapter 2, we have these words, "But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the servant the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they derided and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?'" So you see, they received derision upon arrival from Sanballat, Geshem, and Tobiah. And with that, we noted, there was also the slanderous charge saying that they really intended to rebel against the king. And to this Nehemiah replied in verse 20, "The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or memorial in Jerusalem." The next problem that Nehemiah faced was an internal one. In chapter 3, verse 5, remember we had the notable example of the Tekoites who repaired two sections of the wall. But alas, in verse 5, Next to them the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles did not put their necks to the work of their lord. So the next problem he faces is half-hearted allies in the work. Despite his exhortation and appeal to unity, and they replied by saying, "Let us rise up and build," it became evident that those who were prepared to verbally show an identification with God's work weren't prepared to put their necks to the work of their lord. No doubt they saw many of the problems in so doing. They may even have seen a few of the solutions, but they were unprepared to put their necks alongside the lowly Tekoites and labor to build the walls. These were the armchair Christadelphians in Nehemiah's camp. They were a half-hearted ally that continued collusion with those outside the wall. Now in chapter 4, we have completed the analysis of chapter 3. In chapter 4, we find the reaction now as these adversaries see the work progressing. Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he ridiculed the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brethren and the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that?" And Tobiah the Ammonite was by him. And he said, "Yes, what they're building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." So now Nehemiah moves from half-hearted allies to what we have in verse 2, outright contempt. Contempt for his work expressed by those who are outside the wall. And really this contempt takes two forms. What they say, A, is your ideas are too big. Will they make an end in a day? And secondly, they're saying to Nehemiah, look at your results. The work is just begun, and they say, look at your results. Why? If a fox goes up in your wall, he'll break it down. Now let's look at these two allegations as part of the contempt, as set out here. You see, they saw that the work was prospering, that these huge stones were being fitted into place, and that although they had perfumers or apothecaries, merchants and goldsmiths and priests and Levites, they labored together as an organic unity to build the wall. For, says Nehemiah, the people had a mind to work. Now this greatly enraged Sanballat, because a strong Jerusalem spent a weak Samaria. And so he said in the presence of his brethren, and notice the ominous part of this, the army of Samaria. Remember, he was the king's pika as well, Sanballat. He was the Persian king's official in Samaria, and he has an army at his disposal. So he makes it quite plain to the army of Samaria what his attitude is to the Jews. What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that? Because you recall, Nebuchadnezzar burned the city with fire. And then in a very disparaging way, Tobiah, who was by him, said, "Why, yes, even if a fox goes up on the wall, he will break it down." Now, it may not be apparent what the allusion is here until you compare a statement in the Song of Solomon. In Song of Solomon chapter 2, verse 15, we get the import of this sarcastic remark on the part of Tobiah the Ammonite. In Song of Solomon 2, verse 15, "Catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom." Now the foxes would go through the vineyard fences and eat the grapes. And so the allusion here of Tobiah is that, well, the wall that they're building, that's intended to keep, you know, us Samaritans and you Arabians and Ashdodites out, is of such poor construction that even if a fox that goes through a vineyard fence walked up on it, he would break it down. So your building, Nehemiah, is so futile that it would be just as easy for a fox to go through your wall as it would for him to go through a vineyard fence. So you see, they use very disparaging remarks And notice the way they fit in. Your ideas are too big, Nehemiah. You won't be able to finish. Will you be able to revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish? Will you make an end in a day? Will you restore sacrifices? Nehemiah, your ideas are far too big. And look at your results. The work's only begun, but what you're building is of such poor quality that if a fox goes up, he will break it down. Now, I suppose sometimes all of us can be Sanballat, and usually we can find a few Tobias to have their say as well on matters such as this. I can well imagine some experiences in park work, open-air speaking. When this was initiated, brethren would say, well, how many converts have you made? Sure, you've gone down the park to speak, and you've spoken to the seagulls and to the trees, and to those who go down for entertainment, but how many converts have you made? Where's your conversion? If you want us to come down and help you in the park work, show us some of your converts. And others would say, well, if you make a convert down in that kind of park, he'll probably turn out to be just like you, contentious and argumentative. So you can well see that occasionally, from lack of foresight, sometimes we might be a Sanballat, and even unwittingly, a Tobiah in God's work. You know, in Adelaide, South Australia, they went a whole year and never had a convert and didn't even have a likely convert in their open-air work in Elder Park. I think there are now four or five baptized Christadelphians who learned the truth through open-air work in Elder Park in 2 years since I've been in Australia. So you see, God did bless the work in Elder Park, but you can well imagine those persons who came down in the first year of the brethren's effort there, only to find occasionally very, very few visitors present, plenty of seagulls, lots of open spaces, and maybe a few rather hardened Christadelphians that would come down there as regular individuals. And they might tend to feel, well, what's the use? Might as well go home and study my Bible and stand down here. But because a few brethren had perseverance, had foresight, and dedication, realizing that the revival of God's people requires giving of self, continued the work. And God bless it. So, brothers and sisters, let us be careful that unwittingly we never become a Sanballat and a Tobiah by saying to people, initiating good work in our midst, your ideas are too big. You'll never be able to finish. Will you make an end in a day? Or when the work's just begun, being a wet blanket for God's work and saying, look at the results. What have you got to show for it? Why, what you're doing, it's so insignificant that if a fox goes up, he will break it down. Well, Nehemiah replied, and he said to these adversaries, or at least this was his response, verse 4, hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt upon their own heads, and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from thy sight, for they have provoked thee to anger before the builders. And I suppose these come as very hard words to us, brothers and sisters. And we sometimes wonder if this is really the spirit of Jesus of Nazareth, who instructed us to love our enemies and to bless those who curse you and despitefully use you and persecute you, that one ought to turn the other cheek. And if a man compel thee to go 1 mile, go with him too. I do not believe, brothers and sisters, that we do have a difference of spirit here. And the stress ought to be on these words. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out of thy sight, for they have provoked who? They have provoked thee, says Nehemiah. You see, Nehemiah had such an identification with God's work that really his personal enemies in this great work were really God's enemies. And you know, Nehemiah's statements are much like these imprecatory songs. Like Psalm 139, for example, where we find this identification of the psalmist with God in his hatred of enemies to his work. Psalm 139, verse 19. Oh, that thou wouldest slay the wicked, O God, and that men of blood would depart from me, men who maliciously defy thee, who lift themselves up against thee for evil. Do not I hate them that hate thee, O Lord, And do I not loathe them that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. So you see here the way the psalmist has identified himself with God's work to the complete extent that enemies to God's work constitute an enemy for the psalmist. And that's the way, I believe, Nehemiah viewed the enemies to his work, Sanballat, Geshem, and Tobiah. And Nehemiah says in verse 6 of chapter 4, so we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind or a heart to work. Now the building, you recall, already had the altar and the temple constructed on the basis of the work of Joshua and Zerubbabel, with the great prophecies of encouragement given by Haggai and Zechariah. And Nehemiah labored with his men, using burned stones at that, as the enemy said, stones that had been burned by the great fires of Nebuchadnezzar, and the men labored to build on the wall. And so, as Nehemiah says, the wall was constructed to half its height. Apparently, Nehemiah's strategy was to see that the wall, which commenced in the enumeration of chapter 3, from the sheep gate onward, by the fish gate, the old gate, the Ephraim gate, the valley gate, the fountain gate, the water gate, the horse gate, east gate, prison gate, and muster gate, so that all that wall was constructed then, repaired in the lower sections, and completely rebuilt, apparently, in the north section, to half its height. So he was attempting to protect the workers, protect the temple and the altar, presumably, by having the wall initially constructed to half its height, rather than, say, build the north section of the wall complete, and then build the south section of the wall complete. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, of course, coming from Ashdod, the famous, one of the five famous cities of the Philistines on the western side, and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. So now he faces virtually open opposition. You see, to this time, Nehemiah has faced derision and contempt. That's one thing. But when you're laboring with every man working on the wall as they were, to use an Australian expression, flat out on the wall, working from early morning till late at night, and then to have a hostile confederacy build up where open opposition is their avowed intent, is quite a different thing. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. You can imagine the predicament this placed Nehemiah in. What did he do? We prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. Now notice the balance Nehemiah has, brothers and sisters. Sometimes you see the distortion where people continually emphasize that they've made something a subject of prayer, as if to think that this alleviates them from any responsibility for the decision-making, as if to suggest that because it's been a prayerful consideration on their part, their answer either must be right or that they're absolved from personal effort on their part. But here Nehemiah has a balance, not only prayer, but action. You see, Nehemiah prayed as if it all depended upon God, and then worked as if it all depended upon him. And he had a perfect blend in his work, so that prayer accompanied by action, and the work went on blessed. And we prayed to our God, as Jesus had instructed, watch and pray, and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. But then, internal difficulties once again. Now Nehemiah faces discouragement. He faces discouragement in verse 10, as we've already noted. And Judah said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing. There is much rubbish, and we're not able to work on the wall. And our enemy said, they will not know or see till we come into the midst of them and kill them and stop the work. So now he has sabotage to face. Because they're going to sneak up while they're working on the walls, or come up at night and kill them and stop the work. So by infiltration and sabotage, they're going to stop the work. So you can imagine Nehemiah, who realizes that there's an armed confederacy outside this wall that's planning to come and fight, and then to find inside his own camp at such a time as this, Judah, lying like Judah, coming along and saying to him, Nehemiah, we can't go a step further in the work. The strength of the burden bearers is failing, and there's too much rubbish. Nehemiah, as for us, we can't walk with you any longer. We cannot work on the wall. So Nehemiah then has discouragement. It isn't just the half-hearted allies of the nobles who would put their necks to the work of their lord. Now he finds men who did put their necks to the work of the Lord becoming discouraged. Not only because the strength of the burden bearers was decayed, but Judah saw what was going on outside the walls. And our enemy said, they will not know or see till we come into the midst of them and kill them and stop the work. When the Jews who lived by them came, they said to us 10 times, verse 12, from all the places where they live, they will come up against us. Now, as we noted, there were many people who worked on the wall who traveled back and forth to their towns. When they came back with Ezra, they settled in the hometown of their forebears. In the time of Nehemiah, there were many workers on the wall who journeyed back to Tekoa or to Zanoah or Beth-Hakkerim, and they would spend the night there with their families, with their olives and with their olive trees and their vineyards, and then return to work from early morning till the time the stars came out on the wall. But you see, as they moved back and forth to their little towns, they saw an army amassing, and they made it quite clear what their intention was. And so they complained to Nehemiah. 10 times, said Nehemiah, from all the places where they live, they will come up against us. Remember, the Jews were living as a minority group outside this wall amongst a hostile population. Moabites, Edomites, Ashdodites, Samaritans. So you see, Nehemiah is in tremendous difficulty now. And so this is what he does in verse 13. So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, I stationed the people according to their families, with their swords, their spears, their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember Yahweh, who is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. So Nehemiah, without attempting to make it look like he was interested in an armed repulsion, he, as it were, hides his men in the wide open spaces in the valleys. And like the priests of Israel, who was commissioned to exhort the people when they went to war, Nehemiah undertook the same. And when you go forth to war against your enemies, and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for Yahweh your God is with you. And rather than having Eliashib, who was first and foremost to build from the sheep gate along to the tower of Mia and Hananel, but it didn't even finish the work outside his own house, here we find Nehemiah taking, as it were, the role of the priest and exhorting his men that Yahweh their God would be with them, and therefore there was more with them than was with the aliens. Again, you see the principle of revival of God's people, dependent upon God. Unlike Menahem, unlike Pekah and King Ahaz, who relied on their own machinations and manipulations with the Assyrian power, or with Syria, or with Saul, king of Egypt, we find here Nehemiah exhorts his men because he has faith in God's watchers. He has faith in the unseen chariots of God Almighty. Do not be afraid of them. Remember Yahweh, who is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. And so on the basis of this exhortation to his people, the men take a determined stand against the enemy. Now Nehemiah, of course, is time and time again alluding to the Mosaic law. You shall not be in dread of them, for Yahweh your God is in the midst of you, a great and terrible God. A great and terrible God. And so as with Ezra in his prayer, as with Nehemiah in his prayer before the king, where his prayer is virtually studded with quotations or allusions to God's revelation in the Old Testament, we have here again Nehemiah alluding to Deuteronomy, the great and terrible God. And so when our enemies heard that it was known to us, and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. And from that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail, and the leaders stood behind all the house of Judah, verse 17, who were building on the wall. Those who carried burdens were laden in such a way that each with one hand labored on the work, and with the other hand held his weapon. Now you see, Nehemiah, brothers and sisters, could have easily been a very discouraged ambassador of the great king. You can imagine him, he's left behind Shushan the palace. He had an exalted position, cupbearer to the great king, Darius the Xerxes. And he left that, arrived at Jerusalem to find what? Derision, people dejected, half-hearted allies, contempt, open opposition, discouragement, and sabotage. Now he could well have backseat, brothers and sisters, and many times before that, said, God, if it's your work, then please bless me in my work. But no, for some reason, there were problems, and more problems. Despite the fact he's working at a fantastic rate to see that that wall is completed, that the gates are placed in the openings in the walls to keep out the enemy, he has to face a situation now, not only with men whose strength is decayed, because there is much rubbish. The very people carrying the burdens now have to carry in one hand a javelin or a missile of some kind. So you can see that at every turn, Nehemiah had problems, which for a lesser man, he would have thrown up his hands in despair and said, God, if that's the kind of way you work, then I want neither part nor lot of it. But like Ezra, who even when he attempted to initiate the separation from the aliens, and when they stood out in the open places, it was a time of heavy rain. God didn't automatically manipulate the climatic condition to enhance Ezra's work. They had to stand out in a time of heavy rain. And here, it's a hot Palestinian summer when Nehemiah's working. And God could, as you well know, like he did with the Assyrians. He could have annihilated the enemy outside the camp like that, if he wished to. But you see, this was an ideal situation from God's viewpoint. God's will that he had designed was performing with 100% efficiency the job for which he intended. It was trying character. And so you see, as they worked under the most awkward conditions, and just when you would have expected God to move providentially and to remove the adversaries outside so that spirituality could be increased and enhanced inside, God, his foreknowledge, saw that this was a part of the work to try the faith of men who worked in the walls. And so under the most difficult conditions, they labored. The strength of the burden bearers was weakened, and now they had to carry a javelin or a missile in one hand as they worked pushing and shoving the great huge stones that would make up the walls. As they erected the scaffolding and the timbers that went up as high as 200 feet, they had to do so with one eye on the enemy. And so in verse 17, verse 18, and each of the builders had his sword girded at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me. And I said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, the work is great and widely spread, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. In the place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. Glorious words on the part of this great man, Nehemiah. Our God will fight for us. And you know, it's much like the great exhortation that we find in the book of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, we have these words. In verse 28, whither are we going up? Our brethren have made our hearts melt, saying, the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. And moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. Then I said to you, do not be in dread or afraid of them. Yahweh your God, who goes before you, will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness where you have seen how Yahweh your God bore you, as a man bears his son, and all the way that you went until you came to this place. And so you see, Nehemiah moves on the basis of the great exhortations of his forebears like Moses. And in the place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there, your God will fight for us. And so as they survey their the logistics of their defense, Nehemiah sees that this is a great area all around the walls of Jerusalem, between 2 and 3 miles. And there are large open spaces where it'd be easy for sabotage or infiltration to occur. In fact, most of the houses inside here had all been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. They were all burned down. There was nothing to offer a Jew to come and settle in Jerusalem as such. There was much rubbish. The stones were burned. They weren't going to an area of good facilities, brothers and sisters. It was harsh, barren, and full of rubbish. And so Nehemiah has to exhort them that wherever they are, scattered in the walls working, Shallum and his daughters on one section down here, Hanun, the ruler of half the city of Jerusalem, or whether it be the Tekoites over here, or the merchantmen on the north, or the Tekoites on the left-hand side, where they heard the trumpet blow, there they were to rally. Verse 21, so he labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn till the stars came out. And I said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard for us by night, and they labor by day. So they're virtually doing double duty now. Rather than going back to the little towns, Nehemiah realizes this would virtually leave the city defenseless at night. So he requests the men to reside in the city, to spend the night inside the walls of the city, so that in an emergency they could be called to fight for the city. And so they would sleep in here and then work on the walls in the daytime. And brothers and sisters, you could well imagine, under the extremity of these conditions, they wouldn't be sleeping in nice, soft, chicken down beds. These would be hard, arduous conditions. They wouldn't merely turn on a tap and have hot and cold running water. They would be laboring under difficult conditions as the men working on the walls, tired, sweaty, and soiled at night, would then retire within the city and be ready at any moment's notice to defend the walls. And you get the impression of the extremity, as Nehemiah says in verse 23, so neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes, except each had his weapon in his hand. Apparently, the rendering in the Authorized Version is not well supported there. But anyway, the point is that the situation was viewed to be so critical by Nehemiah that none of those who went with him took off their clothes, except each had his weapon in his hand. And now this takes us to chapter 6. Now it was reported to Sanballat and Tobiah and to Geshem the Arab and to the rest of our enemies that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors and the gates. In other words, Nehemiah is saying that all the wall here had been restored all the way around, but he hadn't as yet taken the timbers from the forest of Asaph to build the gates to complete the defense of the city. And so Sanballat and Geshem sent to me in verse 2, saying, come and let us meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they intended to do me harm. So Nehemiah now faces false friendship. They're saying to him virtually, Nehemiah, by the way, we should note in here another problem they faced. It was the internecine strife or the internal strife over the nobles charging 12% interest, but we've already covered that point. So they come to Nehemiah and say, Nehemiah, let's forget our big difficulties and come and let's have a chat on the plain of Ono. You come on, Nehemiah, leave behind Jerusalem and we'll have a little discussion on the plain of Ono. So Nehemiah has to consider whether he should leave the work of building the walls and go in and have a discussion with the adversaries in the plain of Ono. Now, Nehemiah wasn't going to be tricked in this way. He could well have been kidnapped or murdered, and there they would be taking away the man who's organizing the whole work. So notice his reply. He said, first of all, they intended to do me harm. That was the motive, he gathered. And I sent messengers to them in verse 3 saying, I'm doing a great work. I cannot come down Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent to me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same manner. Now this is really interesting, brothers and sisters. Nehemiah didn't impute motives to them. He may well have known that they intended to do me harm. But he didn't send back to Tobiah and send Malad and Geshem and say, I can't come out and meet you. You might murder me or you might ambush me. Look at the beauty of his response. He doesn't in any way aggravate the situation by an aggressive, militant attitude just because he had his wall in such a way now as to afford greater protection. You never find in Nehemiah a presumptuous man. He's a man who seems to be able to temper wisdom and discretion with his knowledge. And it isn't always, brothers and sisters, that you find that kind of combination. Here was an exceedingly great man in the work. He was the Persian king's governor of the area. He was the unquestioned leader and administrator of this great work. But you see, he didn't, as it were, become overwhelmed by his success. Hezekiah, we read, that when he prospered, his heart was lifted up. And he didn't make return unto the Lord God for all the benefits that accrued to him. Time and again we find the kings of Israel that in their great prosperity they were lifted up in pride and then they fell. When God left them to try all that was in their heart, they could stand the day of affliction, they couldn't stand the day of prosperity. But Nehemiah, we see here, is discreet. He's wise in his answer. I'm doing a great work. I cannot come down to you. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? What a reply. You know, brothers and sisters, if only as young people, we could always have that kind of response whenever we're tempted to play the fool. Whenever someone in the world tempts us, as it were, to play the part of the fool, if only we could echo these words. I'm doing a great work. I cannot come down and see you. Why should God's work stop while I leave it and come down to you? If only that could be our reply to all our false friendships that are offered to us in the world, how much better a community we would be. Nehemiah, doing a great work, I cannot stop to come down and see you. So you see, a false friendship offered no real enticement to Nehemiah. It may have been seen by the adversaries as a form of entreaty. Or, as Nehemiah pointed out, it may have been one of merely a subtle collusion on their part to trap him. Anyway, Nehemiah had no time for a false friendship. He was too busy doing a great work, which he said he could not stop doing. And so they reply in verse 5. In the same way, Sanballat for the fifth time sent his servants to me with an open letter in his hand. Notice, it's an open letter. In it was written, it is reported among the nations, and even Geshem. In other words, it's not a matter of a rumor, Nehemiah. Even this distinguished Geshem, or Gashmu, also says it, that you and the Jews intend to rebel. And that is why you're building the wall. And you wish to become their king according to this report. And you've also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, there is a king in Judah. And now it will be reported to the king according to these words. So now come, let us take counsel together. Well, now Nehemiah has to face the scandal of an open letter. So you see, virtually you have these men united on the basis of hate. And rather than approaching Nehemiah, remember he's the king's pika with a silken purse containing the letter, as would befit the dignity and stature of this man Nehemiah, what do these adversaries do? Well, they resort to an open letter, a scandalous open letter that would defame his character and impute to him false motives. So you see, brothers and sisters, this particular problem that we have back here in Nehemiah is a problem that we can only expect to reoccur wherever we have men involved in standing for truth and engaging in the work of God such that they cannot stop. Paul had similar experiences. The Judaizers came to Corinth and said, we've got letters of recommendation from Jerusalem. Where's your letter, Paul? Where's your letter of commendation? They said of him, well, Paul, you're a great letter writer when you're in Ephesus, but what happens when you come to Corinth? Bodily presence is weak. Speech is contemptible. And so you see, those pseudo-apostles, disguising themselves as ministers of light, defame Paul's character. They defamed Paul's character so effectively that for a time Paul scarcely had a friend left in that ecclesia. So Nehemiah faced the open letter. But even this allegation wasn't a new one, because Ezra had faced this earlier. In chapter 4, Ezra records these words. Sorry, not Ezra, Joshua and Zerubbabel. In Ezra chapter 4, "Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of fathers' houses and said to them, 'Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do. We have been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon,'" and so on. Now, as we know, they responded by saying, "You have neither part nor lot in this work." Look what happened in verse 4. "Then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia." And in verse 7, the adversaries of that time presented a letter. And the letter, we are told in verse 12, had these contents: "Be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone building in Jerusalem, and they are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and the royal revenue will be impaired." Verse 16. "We make it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls finished, you will then have no possession in the province beyond the river." So in a certain way, Geshem, Tobiah, and Sanballat were merely plagiarists. They virtually plagiarized the successful attack of the adversaries in the time of Joshua and Zerubbabel, which succeeded in stopping the work. So look how Nehemiah responded. He responded, first of all, in verse 8, "Then I said to him, saying, 'No such thing as you say has been done.'" That's chapter 6, verse 8. "For you are inventing them out of your own mind. For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking, 'Their hands will drop from the work, and it will not be done.' But now, O God, strengthen thou my hands." So with the scandalous letter, you intend to rebel and become king, and even saying, "Well, you've even got false prophets that are going to proclaim you king," Nehemiah rejects this scandalous charge: "No such things have been done." But you know, there is blackmail here. They were saying, "Nehemiah, if you don't come and meet us in the plain of Ono now, we're going to send this back to the king of Persia that you intend to rebel and become king, and then watch us." But you see, Nehemiah wasn't afraid of this allegation. It was God's word, and he proceeded forth with integrity and righteousness, and he left the implications of their blackmail to God. And he said, "O God, strengthen thou now my hand." You know, one time David, in his experiences, had a very tragic time. Remember when the Amalekites burned Ziklag? And we are told there, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in Yahweh his God. You see, great men like Nehemiah had a personal relationship with God that meant more, brothers and sisters, than the supporting influence of fellow comrades. True, they had fellow laborers to encourage them at times, but these great men must have surely known the fickleness of human allegiance. And so when he's confronted with a serious, scandalous situation, Nehemiah said, "O God, strengthen thou my hand." Like David, when the people were going to stone him because the Amalekites had burnt Ziklag, David strengthened himself personally in the Lord his God. And now they resort to deception and treachery. "Now when I went into the house of Shemaiah the son of Deliah, son of Mehetabel, who was shut up, he said," chapter 6, verse 10, "'Let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they're coming to kill you. At night they're coming to kill you, Nehemiah.'" Now I think we have to read between the lines here. It appears to me that the false prophet must have been in collusion with men outside the wall. Perhaps he was one of the ones, like Meshullam, Berechiah, who had a marriage alliance outside the wall. Anyway, he pretends to have classified information. Somehow he's on the hotline to men outside the wall, and he pretends to be Nehemiah's friend. And he's virtually saying, Nehemiah, I've got inside information. They're coming to kill you. They're coming to kill you at night, Nehemiah. So, Nehemiah, let's come into the temple, and we'll close the doors of the temple, and there your God will protect you. Now, we know that this would be forbidden under God's law, for such a man as Nehemiah, not being a priest, to enter the temple. And I said, should such a man as I flee? And what man such as I could go into the temple and live? And you know, Nehemiah would have in mind the historical examples of the kings of Israel who fell, like King Uzziah, smitten with leprosy in his forehead, when he tried to arrogate the position of the priesthood as well as king. So Nehemiah says, should such a man as I go into the temple and live? You see, Nehemiah never had, as it were, a swelled head because of his work, because of his prosperity in the work, knowing that God was working with him providentially, seeing the successful work of the wall, the breaches all being closed. Nehemiah never presumed to think that because of his special relation to God, that he could come into the temple. Should such a man as I flee? No. Nehemiah was a shepherd for the sheep. Who's the man that flees? Jesus says it's the hireling. It's a hireling who, when he sees the wolf coming, leaves the sheep and runs for his own skin. Nehemiah was no hireling. When he saw the wolf, he faced him as a shepherd. Should such a man as I flee? And what man such as I could go into the temple and live? I will not go in, the decisive answer of Nehemiah. And I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but that he had pronounced the prophecy against me, because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin, and so they could give me an evil name in order to taunt me. Brothers and sisters, have you ever seen any person that was placed in such difficult, subtle environment as Nehemiah? You see, what they were trying to do was to get Nehemiah to go into the temple, first of all, so that they could defame his character, so that he would lose the support of conservative Jewry because he'd gone into the temple. That's what he says. He said, I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. So right inside the wall now we have a man who poses as Yahweh's prophet. He's a counterfeit, just like the pseudo-apostles that Paul said showed up at Corinth, praying themselves as ministers of light. Their end shall be according to their work, said Paul. And here this false prophet was easily detected to be such by Nehemiah, because God had set down in his law the conditions under which the genuine from the counterfeit could be distinguished. In Deuteronomy 13, God had preserved this instruction. If a prophet arises among you, or a dreamer of dreams, and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder which he tells you comes to pass, and if he says, let us go after other gods which you have not known, and let us serve them, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or to that dreamer of dreams. For Yahweh your God is testing you to know whether you love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So it wasn't merely the fact that a prophet could claim to have made a prophecy test that might perchance coincidentally come to pass. There was an additional test. And that additional test was a test of doctrine, what a man has to say. You see, irrespective of what powers a man might claim, if his doctrine is false on that grounds alone, one can dismiss whatever extraordinary powers he may claim to have. And so, as Nehemiah must have realized, this man who instructed him to go into the temple couldn't possibly be a man of God, because his doctrine didn't match his prophecy. And so Nehemiah rejected his claim, and then somehow had discovered that Tobiah and Sanballat were in fact hiring him inside the wall in order to defame his character in the eyes of Jewry. And so they appealed to fear. Nehemiah, they're coming to kill you. They're coming to kill you at night, Nehemiah. Take refuge in the temple. And the appeal to fear, as these men worked in collusion, was unsuccessful. Verse 14. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, according to these things that they did, and also the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. And when all our enemies heard of it, all the nations round about us were afraid, and fell greatly in their own esteem, because unless Yahweh built, labor in vain. For they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. And so here we see the great problems that Nehemiah faced. Scandal, false friendship, fear, and then treason. And the treasonous alliance we have already indicated in our consideration last night. Nehemiah called it this great evil and treachery, because there were men inside his own ecclesia who had alliances with Tobiah outside. Moreover, in verse 17, in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. For many in Judah were Baal, bound by oath to him, because he was son-in-law of Shechaniah the son of Era, and his son Jehohanan had taken the daughter of Meshullam the son of Berechiah, a notable priest, as his wife. Also they spoke of his good deeds in my presence, and reported my words to him, and Tobiah sent letters to make me afraid. And so we see how the pieces fit with our consideration last night. All the while Nehemiah is laboring under the greatest adversity to finish this wall in 52 days, and its derision, slander, half-hearted allies, contempt, your ideas are too big, look at your results, will you make an end of the day? Discouragement, when lion-like Judah says the rubbish is much, the strength of the burden bearers is decayed. Attempts at sabotage, appeals to false friendship, an appeal of friendship that was false, a scandalous open letter, an appeal to Nehemiah's fear, and then he discovers that all the while he's been laboring in that wall, there was an Eliashib, first and foremost in the work, in the highest places of the work. Eliashib, brothers and sisters, was the high priest of the day. There was Meshullam, who stood when they read from the book of the law. Meshullam, who sealed his covenant with an oath and a curse to walk in Yahweh's precepts. Meshullam, in charge of laying the vessels. And through apostasy, he allowed his daughter to marry Tobiah's son. And so all the work that these Jews did, brothers and sisters, to build the stone, to build the walls, as they labored to build these great huge walls, with all the scaffolding and the timber, with the blistered hands and sore muscles, with all that work, who walks in? Eliashib allows Tobiah to walk right through the gate. Not an arrow has to be shot, not a stone has to be flung. Nehemiah goes to Persia, and good-hearted Eliashib says to Tobiah, come on in, and you can have the precincts of the Levites for your furniture. You know, it's hard for us to credit that people could have been so foolish in Nehemiah's day. We look back in retrospect and see that repeatedly Nehemiah was right. You have neither part nor lot in Jerusalem, he told the Samaritans, Geshem, Tobiah, and Sanballat. But on the other hand, there were those who kept saying, Nehemiah, look at the good deeds of Tobiah. Tobiah is not such a bad fellow. After all, he's accomplished this and this and this, and we have a marriage alliance with him. We're bound to know to Tobiah. Nehemiah, why don't you let Tobiah become part of us and work in our work? We said last night, brothers and sisters, Tobiah was a wolf. These men could only see the sheep's clothing. They couldn't see that he had teeth of a wolf and claws of a wolf. And because Meshullam was prepared to build two sections of the wall to stand with his wide-marked Bible, he never grew spiritually. He never grew in the fear of God with a personal relationship with God like Nehemiah and Ezra had. He had never prepared his heart to study God's law so that he could detect the spiritual wickedness in high places. And so they continued to erode Nehemiah's influence as he worked under all these extreme conditions. men inside that Israelite ecclesia were fraternizing, fellowshipping the alien outside. And so look what happened. Eliashib moves in and takes over the temple chamber in Nehemiah's absence. The priests had to flee. They were unable to be supported then. They went back to their hometown to provide food and money for their families. They returned to their fields. As a result, temple worship forsaken. The worship of Yahweh, it's finished. Sabbath profaned outside the fish gate. Nehemiah comes back and hears there are Jewish buyers and noisy men from Joppa and Tyre selling fish on the Sabbath. And he walks out and he finds out, why, the kids are speaking the language of the Ashdodites, the Ammonites, and the Moabites. And so you can see, an unwise decision by men who could only see good in Tobiah and could never see the wolf teeth and wolf claws and look at the havoc that was wrought in God's ecclesia. They virtually profaned every element of the covenant that they sealed. So, brothers and sisters, in our consideration of the work of this great man of God, Nehemiah, let us have the foresight, the wisdom, by having prepared our hearts to study the law of God, that we can see and recognize the Eliashib, that we can see and recognize the Merimoth, and see and recognize the Meshullim. That perchance, like Nehemiah, we might say before God Almighty, O God, strengthen thou my hands for this good work, and plead that God Almighty, in his day of inspection, might remember us for good and not for evil.